Hello, folks. This is your host, Charlie Dixon. Before we begin today's episode, we have a special announcement. Join us for the 2024 Triad Summit Series. Mark your calendars for May 17th from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Pacific. This event is online and completely free to attend. At this one-day summit, you'll have the opportunity to learn from two esteemed experts as they share valuable strategies for addressing the mental health crisis, aiding in trauma recovery, stress management, and helping individuals reach their highest potential. Don't miss this chance to connect with innovators in mental health, gain insights from industry leaders, and foster connections within the wider wellness community. Learn more and reserve your spot today at triadhq.com/TSS. I hope to see you at the summit.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast brought to you by the Triad Network. This podcast is designed to share trending topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a behavioral and mental health perspective.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a Triad production. I'm your host, Charlie Dixon. My guest today is Craig Joseph. Craig Joseph, MD, is a seasoned physician informaticist. Known for his extensive background in healthcare and technology spanning 25 years. As Nordic Global's Chief Medical Officer, he embodies a commitment to enhancing healthcare through human-centered design, technology, and common sense. Beginning as a primary care pediatrician, Dr. Joseph transitioned to health IT, playing a crucial role in building the foundation system at Epic and implementing electronic healthcare records across the U.S. and Europe. As an acclaimed author of the book, Designing for Health, The Human-Centered Approach, Craig delves into the challenges of repairing the healthcare system and the opportunity for technology to help. We're excited to have Craig with us today to discuss complexities of a fractured healthcare system and highlighting the crucial role of technology for the betterment of both patients and providers. We are so excited to have you here with us, Craig. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
As we get started, what sort of challenges were you seeing in healthcare when you were a practicing physician, and how did they inspire your change in direction from direct practice to working more with informatics?
Just to give a little perspective, I'm a primary care pediatrician. I practiced primary care pediatrics for about 9 years in the suburbs of Detroit before looking for ways that I could take a little technical background I had. My undergraduate degree was computer science. And so I was looking for some way to connect what I'd done in college and what I'd learned practicing clinically. And that kind of moved me into looking for other opportunities. And one of those was working for an electronic health record software vendor. And so in terms of your first question is, you know, what are some of the problems that we see? There's lots of problems. I think most people agree that they often find a doctor that they like, or a social worker or a therapist. And that part works fine. So when I'm in the office or when I'm sometimes even in the emergency department or in the hospital, I connect with humans and it works. But pretty much everything else is not so great, especially here in the United States. So scheduling an appointment can be difficult. Getting the documentation, did your kids have all their shots? Where are those records? Where are the records of your test results from 5 years ago? Those kinds of things are difficult. Paying for healthcare is very difficult. You don't know how much it's going to be when you go in. And oftentimes, even when you're done with an office visit, if you were to ask someone, how much would this be? They still won't know because they're going to tell you, oh, we've got to look at the documentation and the patient and the progress note to have any clue as to how much this will cost, even if you're paying cash. So lots of opportunities for problems. I was hoping to be able to connect, and I think I've succeeded, to connect some of the dots and help leverage technology and now human-centered design to make things a little better. I'm certainly not telling everyone that we've fixed it. It is very broken, but I think we can make it better by, you know, looking at some of the processes, understanding how humans think, and then making it easy to do the right thing and a little bit more difficult to do what we think is the wrong thing.
Got you. And so you just mentioned that you try to do things in a human-centered approach. Tell me more about how you look at human-centered approach and what that looks like as far as healthcare and merging that with technology.
Yeah. So it's actually all started, at least my experience, in reading a book by someone called Don Norman. And it was called Psychology of Everyday Things. Now it's called Design of Everyday Things. And one of the very first chapters in that book talked about doors, which doesn't seem like a very exciting topic. But he took pictures of doors all over the world and showed how difficult they were to use. And one would think, well, it's a door, you know, Craig. That's not really hard. Well, sometimes, and I bet I'm not the only one, you go and you grab a handle and you go to pull it open and the door doesn't budge. And yeah. Your first thought is the door locked? Is this place not open? And then your second thought is, oh, I guess I'm supposed to push. Sometimes that's fixed because you can see a sign. So there might be a sign that says push or pull. And sometimes you don't even know which way you're supposed to be pushing on a door. Is it on the left side or is it on the right side? And basically what I learned from Don Norman was that if you need instructions to use a door, it's probably a poorly designed door. And taking that to healthcare, you know, if you need instructions about how to do basic things in our healthcare ecosystem, then it's probably poorly designed. And anything that we can do to move us in the right direction is helpful. We now know it's, and when I say design, sometimes people think about, oh, what color do I like? Or should I have frills on that shirt or not? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about understanding how we think on how humans engage with their environment and trying to make it easy to work within that, right? So making it so that I don't have to think so much, like the natural thing that I want to do is to do the right thing. Now, the hardest part is figuring out what is the right thing. And so, you know, when I say that, oftentimes there's not a right or a wrong answer. So I'll give you an example. For patients that are admitted to the hospital for community-acquired pneumonia, typically the infectious disease experts have said, oh, in our area of the country or in our area of the state, we find these two antibiotics are the best for patients with pneumonia that are coming into the hospital. Okay, they've now decided what we want people to do. That's the good answer, is to use one of these antibiotics. And so the question is, how do we make it easy for physicians to do the right thing, to choose one of those two antibiotics, knowing that sometimes you have difficult or more complicated patients and or they've tried those antibiotics before and they failed. So, you know, that is not always the only answer, but it's a good starting answer for 70 or 80% of the patients. And much in the same way, when you approach a door, there's a handle. What do you want to do? You want to pull. You want to pull on the handle. And if there's a flat metal plate on the left side of the door, you want to push on that flat metal plate, right? I mean, those are things. So why do we put handles on both sides of a glass door? Now that I pointed out, you won't go a day without seeing handles on both sides of the door. And you're going to look and you're like, why? Why couldn't someone just decide? I'm going to be wrong half the time, every time. And if you put instructions like push and pull, that's great. But still, now I have to think about it. And even though it's not taking too much of my mental energy to think about looking at push and pull, assuming that I speak the language, it's still taking some energy. And I don't want to expend that. So those are the little things that we try and do and try to apply to healthcare.
So being the healthcare force is designed for humans, why do you think that the human element has been missing in that connection? Like, why was it always included?
Well, you know, oftentimes we're not intentional when we design things, right? Most people who know anything about the healthcare system in the United States actually won't even say it like that. They'll say it like this: the healthcare system. They'll put air quotes around the word system because system implies someone thought this thing through and put it together this way. In fact, it was built more like an old house that we've put a bunch of additions on, right? Oh, we need another bedroom. Okay, well, let's make the best addition that we can. Oh, now we need to make the kitchen bigger, but we don't have a lot of space where we'd really like to put it. And so our healthcare system in the US has kind of been cobbled together, and it's not really a system in any meaningful way. And so there's ample opportunities for improvement. One that I just referenced before, you asked about, hey, what's broken? Payment system, right? The way that most physicians are reimbursed for their services in the United States is called the fee-for-service, meaning if you do something, you get paid, which is great. That's great for lawyers and accountants and salespeople and car manufacturers. If you sell a car, you get paid. If you don't sell a car, you don't get paid. Healthcare, though, it's a little different, right? If you're incentivizing people, physicians, hospitals, to do something, then you shouldn't be shocked that they do those things, right? Yep. So, hey, you know, if I order an MRI or if I read an MRI or I, you know, if I don't, there's an incentive there. And so kind of aligning incentives system-wide can certainly be one area where you can look for improvements. But so it's not shocking that when we incentivize doctors and hospitals to provide care that they do that. Sometimes we know that actually doing less is actually more helpful, right? Physicians like to order EKGs or electrocardiograms before patients have surgeries because they're like, well, just to be certain, even though you don't have any heart problems and even though this is just an operation on your, it's a knee replacement, nowhere near your heart, you know, just to be sure. We know scientifically from studies that if you don't have heart problems already or you don't have any symptoms or signs that point to us that make us think that you have a heart problem, probably shouldn't order that EKG. And the reason we shouldn't is that often something is a little amiss on it, right? It's one of those things where the cardiologist will look at the EKG and say, I don't think it's anything. I'm not sure it's something. So we probably want to make sure it's not something. So we're going to order another test, right? Mm-hmm. So oftentimes, A, we're adding cost to the system. And sometimes to the patient, sometimes not, but we're certainly adding costs. We're adding time. So now you're not getting your knee replacement when you thought you were getting your knee replacement because it's going to take time now to do this workup. Sometimes people have studies that are dangerous. You know, if you're looking at the carotid arteries in the heart and we want to get a good view, you know, we're going to have to catheterize you and do a coronary angiogram to take really good pictures. That is not a 100% safe study. So there are risks involved. And so sometimes what we find is that doctors who are well-meaning, like, well, what could be, you know, harm in ordering an EKG? That could be the harm, is that it leads to other tests that are unnecessary and then leads to a test where you have a bad outcome or a procedure where you have a bad outcome. So those are some of the things that I think are designed into our healthcare system that we'd like to try to minimize.
Got you. And so you've mentioned a few of the challenges that you see. So how do you look at and really identify the challenges when you're working with a hospital system to really figure out how to make them better?
Yeah, that's where the rubber meets the road. So even just going on that example I just gave of ordering what I might call an unnecessary test, or actually the more appropriate term would be a low value test, meaning something that's unlikely to provide value. Again, if you're going into the emergency room, clutching your chest with chest pain, and you're, you know, sweaty and you feel like there's an elephant on your chest, okay, those are signs that you're having a heart attack. We definitely want to do an EKG. But if you're having a knee replacement, I don't know. So how do you kind of use design to make it easy for doctors to do the right thing? In this case, the right thing is not ordering an EKG for a patient that's having a low risk surgery with no history. And so, you know, we could do things like we have an order set, and that's something that physicians are comfortable with at this point. An order set is just a set of orders. And orders in a hospital are generally things like medications, prescriptions, lab tests, nursing communication orders, asking a nurse to do something, those kinds of things. A diet is an order in a hospital. And so we have these order sets, and kind of think of them as recipes. And I mentioned before, a patient coming in for pneumonia. Well, that's a pretty typical patient. We see a lot of those patients, and we have this recipe for that patient, and it's called an order set. And we give it to physicians. And basically, when it was on paper, before we had computers everywhere, it was just a piece of paper with a bunch of orders and a bunch of boxes. And you would check the ones you want. I want an EKG. I want an echo. This is the diet order that I want, that kind of thing. Hey, don't put an EKG on the order set for a patient who's coming in for a knee replacement surgery, right? It's not rocket science. If we don't put it there, does that mean that the doctor can't order it? It does not mean that, because there are going to be times where you're coming in for a knee replacement and you should get an EKG. Those times exist, but they're not common. And so what is the doctor to do? We give them some blank lines at the bottom of the sheet of paper, right? And say, hey, you can write any orders down there. So we're making it easy to do the right thing by not including a box where it's just easy to check, but we're not making it impossible, because there are times where that wrong thing is actually the right thing. So it could be as simple as that. It also could be, now that we're computerized in most hospitals, mm-hmm. it could give you some kind of what we call a clinical decision support, a pop-up on your screen. So, you know, if you're ordering a test that we think is low value, and again, these are very specific examples where we know what the patient's coming in for, we know what the history of the patient is, and we see that you're ordering an EKG before this operation, you know, you might get a pop-up that says, hey, this is considered a low value exam for most patients. Just wanted you to be aware. That's terrific if the physician's open to that kind of feedback. It's not so terrific if they're a super specialized cardiologist who's like, yeah, I know. That's why the patient's seeing me and not someone else. It's not terrific if the information in the electronic health record is not up to date. Hey, this is not a good test to do because this patient doesn't have any heart problems. Oh, yeah? 2 weeks ago, they were in the hospital for a heart attack. So I'm not sure they don't have any heart problems, right? Kind of look dumb when that happens. And there are opportunities to kind of mess that system up, but those are the kind of ways that we either leverage technology or just design in general to make it easy to do the right thing and slightly more difficult to do the wrong thing.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Most of us spend more time at work than anywhere else doing anything else. So why not spend that time in a job you love? Introducing Triad's Jobs Marketplace, the only job site dedicated specifically to behavioral and mental health professionals. Featuring more than 1,000 open jobs from dozens of behavioral and mental health employers, and searchable by location, professional field, employment type, specialization, and more. Jobs Marketplace helps you find your next career opportunity. Full-time, part-time, or gig time, make the most of your time. To access Jobs Marketplace, register for your free professional account at hellotriad.com/BHT. That's hellotriad.com/BHT. And then click to Jobs Marketplace. If you're already a member of the Triad community, visit app.hellotriad.com/jobs. That's app.hellotriad.com/jobs. Visit us today and take your next career step tomorrow.
Given that, and that just that discussion that you just had, have you experienced any times or situations where the doctors don't really appreciate this advancement in technology? Like maybe a physician has been practicing for a while and is more used to being, let's check off these boxes. How does that go?
Yeah, not well. I was going to joke and say, no, it's never happened where a physician has been unhappy with us bringing technology into their room. When my children were younger and I was going on a business trip, this is back when I was working for a software vendor that made electronic health records, they would often ask me where I'm going. And I'd always say the same thing, daddy's going to get yelled at by doctors. Now, because they were very comfortable with the things that they've been doing for decades. And it's been on paper since all of us can remember. And now we're moving to the computer, and the computer, well, it's smart, it's not that smart. And on paper, I could write anything I wanted. I just told you there was a line. Literally, there's a line. Do you have a pen? You could write anything that you want. And the computer won't let you do that. It's a little bit more restrictive. So certainly there were lots of folks, some of whom had good intentions, some of whom didn't have great intentions, mm-hmm. who didn't want to use the technology. That time, at least in the United States, pretty much has passed. Even people who are unhappy with their electronic health record system, when you say, okay, would you like to go back to paper? I haven't found anyone who's like, yeah, let's do that. You know, there's so much information that you didn't have. And back when I started practicing, we were all on paper everywhere, and we were accustomed to not knowing. We were accustomed to not having access to, hey, this patient was admitted to the hospital 3 years ago. What happened during that hospitalization? Mm-hmm. We don't know. And we would often find out maybe the next day when the medical record came up to us. But remember, it wasn't actually kept at the hospital. It was kept at some offsite
building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was right. It was exactly. First, I had to ask for it. And then someone had to go get it. And then they mm-hmm. had to bring it back. And then they had to bring it up to the room or to the floor where the patient was. And all that took time. And now it's instant. And now it's not just that I can find out what happened at my hospital. But if this patient was hospitalized at a different hospital or went to the emergency room in a different part of the country, often I can get at least basic information. I may not be able to see everything. So there's huge benefits to, you know, moving to technology. Is it all great? No. Have we at some point for some things made it worse? Yes. Yes, we have. And one example is just writing our progress notes in the hospital, or even when you go to visit the doctor in the office, they write down notes about what's going on. What are your concerns today? What are your medical problems? What have I done or what have others done to identify those? Are there tests? Are there imaging studies that were done? What did your physical exam show today? And then most importantly, what is my assessment and plan, right? What do I think is going on and what am I planning to do about that? That's all in the note. In paper, that was very concise. We used all kinds of abbreviations to make it difficult for you to understand. We didn't really do it for that reason, but it was very difficult to understand because A, most of us can't handwrite for anything. We can barely read our own writing, let alone have you read our writing. Then we're using all kinds of abbreviations that maybe made sense to us, but didn't make sense to you. Just the really important things. Now with computers, boy, it's easy to bring in all kinds of information. Like instead of me saying, literally, this is what I would have said when I was writing a note on paper, I might say something like, I'd want to say, I looked at the chest x-ray and it was normal, right? In the previous world, I would write CXR, which is our abbreviation for chest x-ray. And then I would make a dash, like a minus sign with a circle around it, which is medical speak for negative. So I would just write CXR negative and everyone would know like, oh, the chest x-ray was unremarkable. Nowadays, people just go to the chest x-ray report that the radiologist dictated, which is usually 300-400 words. I would look at it and go, yeah, okay, it's negative. But they can't say that. They say a lot more. So they'd copy that just like you copy things from Word or from your email program and then paste it in. And so now these progress notes, whether they're inpatient or in the clinic, they're huge, lots of information in them because it's easy to put that information in, which is, you might think that's fine. More information is better. Not really. Not often it's not better because now I've lost the thought of the person writing the note. If I see 5 pages of text, I'm like, what's the important part? Like, where's the important information? It used to be, since I was handwriting it, everything was important because if it wasn't really important, I didn't write it down. And now it's much, much longer. So there's a lot of information in there, but oftentimes you lose the story. You lose your sight of what's the most important. So there are areas where the technology has not been helpful to us. We're working on that, but that's a thorny problem. I'd say in general to your question, most physicians now, especially in the United States, not everywhere, but in the United States, they've learned to live with their electronic health record. They don't want to go back to paper, but they are still appropriately demanding improvements. And we got to keep going because there's so much room for improvement.
Nice. And so we've discussed a bit about the challenges, making sure helping physicians to make the right choices and things like that. Can you give us some more examples about solutions that have worked, how those solutions were implemented, and what the success that you were able to see for patients and really for physicians as well?
Yeah, we could talk for a long time about some of the problems that we've seen. You know, we have one chapter in the book called Getting Rid of Stupid Stuff, which is abbreviated GROSS. I like to have a chapter called GROSS. This wasn't our idea. This actually came from the title of an article in the New England Journal of Medicine about a doctor in Hawaii who went around her hospital asking people, hey, what's dumb? What do we make you do that you consider dumb or stupid? And let's see if we can get rid of that. One example would be finding out what the smoking status is of a 2-year-old. That makes a lot of sense for an adult. Like, hey, are you smoking? Have you ever smoked? How much do you smoke? A 2-year-old, we certainly want to know if the 2-year-old is exposed to secondhand smoke, but it's really, really unlikely that the 2-year-old is themselves smoking. So that, you know, that's kind of stupid to ask that question in that way. There was another question that was really appropriate for a newborn. We cut your umbilical cord when you're delivered and that dries up and falls off usually 3, 4, 5 days. I think most parents know about this. Sometimes it takes a little while for that belly button to dry up. Sometimes it gets infected. And so we want to ask questions in the first 10, 14 days or so, you know, of the parent who's bringing the child to us for a checkup. Hey, how's the belly button? Have you noticed any discharge? That kind of thing makes complete sense. That question was incorporated into the electronic health record at this one healthcare system to be asked at 2 months of age, at 4 months of age, and at 6 months of age. Okay. why would you ask a nurse or a medical assistant who's filling out these forms? Like, why would you ask them to ask a parent at 2 months of age if that belly button is still there? That's a weird kind of question. That doesn't make any sense. So the technical term for that is stupid. That's stupid. And it was a mistake. And it's a valid question at 1 week or 2 weeks of age. It really doesn't make any sense after that. And no one had ever fixed it. No one had ever fixed it. And you'd think, well, it's a minor thing. It's a minor thing to fix for sure. But it's also a minor thing for the nurse. Like, oh, just click it. And that's what they did. Oh, just answer the question. Just move on. It doesn't make any sense. But lots of things in life don't make sense. Fixing those little kinds of problems, sometimes we call them pebbles that are in your shoes, can make a big difference. And so going through and looking for stupid stuff makes a big difference. I'd mentioned order sets before. The order sets are really helpful because they kind of remind doctors, like a cheat sheet for a doctor. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's a cheat sheet to make you just go so that you can go faster. If all the orders that I typically want for a typical patient, again, I gave that example of pneumonia. We see a ton of patients come into the hospital with pneumonia. We usually try to manage it as an outpatient in the clinic, but sometimes you need to come into the hospital for some more support. And so giving you all those orders makes you faster. So you don't have to type each one in individually. Makes sense. But another reason for order sets is for things that you see uncommonly. So I'll give a good example of carbon monoxide poisoning. This is not something that we see very often. And where do we see it? The power went out and it's cold and someone had a generator and they ran the generator either in their house or in their garage, or somehow the carbon monoxide got pumped in and it's very dangerous and certainly you can die. And so if patients come into the hospital, so that's not something you see every day, thankfully, but the treatment is not obvious. And we all kind of know what to do, but how do I order that again? And what lab tests and how often am I supposed to do that? I know there's a protocol for that. Those kinds of questions. That's an order set. That's a great use for an order set because, again, more like a cheat sheet for things that I kind of know how to do, but I haven't done in a long time. And normally I'd have to open up a book or go to a website to see exactly what I'm supposed to do because I only do this twice or three times a year. Order set's great. What we've seen some hospitals do is say, you know what? We have too many order sets. We have hundreds and hundreds, thousands sometimes of order sets. And we're going to look for the ones that doctors are not using and get rid of them just so they don't clutter up the space. I totally agree with that. Except for some of them, like that carbon monoxide exposure, some of them like, oh, I'll give you another one, a snake bite. If you're in Arizona, you probably see a lot of snake bites, but if you're in a city, you probably don't see too many snake bites, or in parts of the country where you don't see it too often. How do you order the anti-venom and what are you supposed to be testing for? And some of those other things, yeah, that's very helpful to have in an order set. So even if that order set's only used a couple times a year, it's a very important order set. We wouldn't want to get rid of that. And so sometimes you're trying to do the right thing by getting rid of some of the junk that's sitting around in the system. And in fact, that's super, super helpful. It's just very uncommon and rare.
Gotcha. I really like the merge of the two where you're able to see where there is a problem and really try to figure out how to fix it, but then looking at all the different pieces of that. I really enjoyed that you brought that to healthcare. I don't know that I've heard that aspect of it before.
Yeah. You know, essentially what you're talking about is clinical informatics. It's a whole field of medicine that didn't exist 20 or 30 years ago, where we tried to understand how we can leverage technology to make healthcare better. And so it's a whole specialty now. In fact, you can be board certified in clinical informatics. And to sit for the boards, you have to do a fellowship now. I'm old. I was grandfathered in. So I was allowed to take the test just because I'd been working in it for so long. And when I started, there was no such thing as clinical informatics or a fellowship. So there are folks like me. I'm not the only one. There's thousands of us actually around the country. We focus on how do we leverage technology to make healthcare better for doctors, for nurses, for physical therapists, for patients, for everyone involved in the healthcare ecosystem.
It's really cool. So can you share with us a hallmark story of a hospital system or just a specific hospital that you work with and how you were able to guide them into better treatment and addressing their patients' needs?
Yeah. You know, I think one example is something that's happening a lot now, which is messaging your physicians. You've always been able to message your physicians. It worked like this. You picked up the telephone and you said, I'm calling my doctor. But curiously, your doctor never answered the phone. someone from your doctor's staff answered the phone. So even though we say you're calling your doctor, you're never really getting to your doctor. You're getting to your doctor's nurse. And then the nurse or medical assistant or whoever was helping the doctor would triage those messages. And mm-hmm. then some of them, they would answer right away. So they knew the answer. So for an mm-hmm. instance, when I was practicing, I used to get a lot of questions from moms and dads about the children's Tylenol. How much can I give them? Is it safe to give them? Like, those were questions that never got to me because my medical assistants and nurses knew how to answer those questions and explain to them how to measure out the right amount for the baby's weight and that kind of stuff. Sometimes those were good questions, but I was able to answer them very quickly. And so the nurse would call you back and say, oh, I talked to the doctor and this is what they said. And then there were the third category where like, oh, this is really complicated. You're going to need to talk to me. And then I would call you back at the end of the day or something like that. With technology now, we have patient portals. We have the ability for patients to kind of log in and send questions to their doctor. And unlike before, when in the olden days, 10, 15 years ago, where when you said, I'm calling my doctor, you never actually got your doctor. Often, the way these technology systems were set up is when you're messaging your physician, you actually are messaging your physician. Like, it goes right to them. Doesn't pass go, doesn't collect $200, goes right to them. And they get a little kind of like mail in their inbox. And you can imagine, I just have a simple question. Okay, they still have to look at it. And it's generally they're doing this between patients or doing it after hours or doing it at home. We call that pajama time, because you're answering some of these questions hours and hours later. I think one of the big mistakes and opportunities for improvement were to say like, wait a second, like we really should go back to the system that we had developed over decades that was working, which is these messages should not go directly to the physician. They should go to a group of nurses or a nurse who's working with the physician and then let them go through and triage that list. So answer questions that they can answer. Again, how much Tylenol do I give? Do I have to refrigerate the amoxicillin? These are questions that I used to get all the time. Some questions were like, hey, I just wanted to make sure that my child could wait for this vaccine until next week. Sometimes they could answer that. Sometimes I answer that very quickly, though, and then they could go and take care of that. And so this kind of team-based approach, this is how we used to practice medicine. Mm-hmm. How we say we still want to practice medicine, it really was a team in that I didn't have to do everything. I did my part and other people played their parts. When the computers started coming in, it was easy to make assignments to a single doctor. It was more complicated to find the right nurse, a pool of nurses. Well, we'll just send it to the doctor. It'll only take them a few minutes. And what we found, especially with the pandemic, when offices were essentially closed at the beginning, just got overwhelmed. And as offices started opening up, we thought the message volume will go back down. Mm-mm. It didn't. And I know that we all have had that experience where let me just ask the doctor this question. It's gotten to a point where now some hospital systems, some healthcare systems are charging for some of those messages. And with the rationale, it says, hey, if it takes a doctor more than 5 minutes of time to look at your question, to research your question, because again, oftentimes you're asking a question, well, I need to go back and look through the chart because I don't remember when your last test was and I don't remember what your lab mm-hmm. value was. So that's like research that I have to do.
Yeah,
it's important. Someone's got to do it. And then to how much time does it take me to type that answer out to you? And so they've started to bill for that kind of information. Now, we never billed for phone calls. So it seems a little weird to be able to bill for a message, but it's something in between a phone call and an office visit. And sometimes with these questions, it really is things that would be just as easily discussed at an office visit. But you don't want to come in. First of all, it takes time to get to an office visit. And then you got to drive and then you got to park and then you got to wait. And if we can have that conversation asynchronously, just going back and forth, or even if we can do a virtual visit, yeah, it's probably worth it. And insurance companies many will pay for some of those kinds of messages, but that's one of those things where that was an unintended consequence. We did not realize that was going to happen. But when it happened, I think one of the ways, again, fixing it, sometimes it's like team-based, let other people answer these questions. And sometimes it's, I'll answer them, but there's going to be a fee for that. And then we're not really at the point yet, but I'm hoping we'll get to the point where healthcare systems actually see this as valuable and give doctors time to do it. Because again, in the past, you were judged based on how many patients you saw
yep.
in the clinic, right? Did you come and I see you in the office visit? That's what I got paid for. Everything else didn't get paid for that. How do we now go and make sure doctors are getting time, including in their day, so that when they leave the office, they actually leave the office behind and don't have to deal with pajama time after they tuck their kids into bed and sit for literally an hour, two, sometimes 3 hours at home, all uncompensated, all uncompensated. Yeah, it's crazy. So helping, you know, hospitals and healthcare systems figure that kind of stuff out is a lot of what we do.
Understood. I really appreciate that there's an ever-changing situation here where this is the problem, let's fix it, but then this happens, so let's fix it. I really appreciate that that is what is happening with healthcare. And I completely agree with you that everybody deserves that self-care time and the ability to leave the office at the office, no matter what your occupation may be. It is incredibly important because you've got people or yourself even at home to take care of. Thank you for that.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So is there a final word you'd like to leave with us on the importance of this lens, the human-centered design in healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I were to sum it all up, it's if you're a healthcare leader, you should be intentional and thinking about design in your work. And that means if you're creating a new tool, if you're creating a new workflow, if you're building a new clinic or building a new hospital, mm-hmm. you should be thinking about how humans are going to interact and what you want them to do and make it easy for that thing to happen. And I think, again, the major thing is intentionality, really thinking about it. We just like, oh, that's how we do it. That's how we've always done it. And it might work and it might not work. Yeah, that would be my key message, is just thinking about the design at a very high level and making sure you understand what your goals are, and then leveraging design to make it easy to achieve those goals, or easier.
I appreciate your time with us here today, because I'm not sure about our listeners, and I hope it's the same for them. You've really opened my mind to looking at healthcare as not just we see a doctor and get our prescription and we go on about our day, really looking at it from that human-centered approach and being able to merge the worlds of technology and fixing people, fixing the things that are wrong there. So yeah. Where can our listeners learn more about your book, Designing for Health, The Human-Centered Approach? Where can they learn more about Nordic Global? And where can they learn more about you and your work?
Yeah, the book is available on Amazon. And so, you know, just going to Amazon and then typing in my name or Designing for Health will get you there. And certainly that'd be appreciated. I work for a Nordic consulting company, as you mentioned, and I write a blog post every 3 weeks or so. And that's available at nordicglobal.com. And you can learn more about what we do. And in terms of learning more about me, it's pretty much those two places and LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn and my writing is there as well. Every now and then I'm on Twitter, but not as much recently. But yeah, LinkedIn is probably a good place to seek me out.
Nice, nice. I will definitely be looking for you on LinkedIn. So accept my request, okay?
All right, I will.
And thank you so much, Craig, for being with us here today. I really appreciate speaking with you.
It's been great.
And thank you to our listeners for taking the time to join Craig and I. The resources for this episode and an archive of all of our other episodes can be found on our webpage at triadhq.com/BHT. And we look forward to having you back with us next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Network, all rights reserved.